So I've been tasked sort of with doing a review on the superluminality. So some of the stuff I'm going to say has already been mentioned briefly, but I'm going to review it. So some of you will know this story, and maybe some will be less familiar. I should say from the outset that some of these slides, particularly the nice ones, were made by Claudia that she sent to me. And she apologizes for not being here. She says, sorry, I couldn't be there. I'm busy reading Lucky Luke, Lucky Luke. And for those of you that don't know the cartoon Lucky Luke, Lucky Luke is famous because he's il est l'homme qui tire plus vite que son ombre, which means that he's the man that shoots faster than his shadow, which I take to mean that his he is shooting superluminally. So so our children there are at least learning about superluminalities whilst we're here. So let's start off. So what's the speed of information? So the velocity of a particle is unambiguous. We don't really need to debate over that. So that there is a debate here is because we know that at some level things really aren't particles, but they're fields. And the velocity of fields already gets confusing, fields are waves. And we know, at the very least, there's two concepts of velocity for fields and waves, the phase velocity and the group velocity. And many undergraduates are told that the phase velocity can become superluminal without violating causality, that the group velocity is the speed of information. And this, of course, is known, well known to be wrong, but nevertheless, it's often what we tell students. And in fact, it was understood by Sommerfeld shortly after the invention of special relativity. There were experimentalists and people that said, well, special relativity must be wrong because we know that the group and phase velocity can be superluminal. And it was Sommerfeld that sort of first looked at this and resolved that particular problem and realized, he was the one that realized that both the phase velocity and the group velocity can be superluminal without contradicting special relativity. Only what Sommerfeld called the wavefront, or I usually just call the front velocity, needed to be luminal. And I'll explain why that is the case, not in the way Sommerfeld but in a slightly different way. And the front velocity is just the phase velocity at k is infinity. That's its definition. So it's a k-independent quantity. It's one number. And only that quantity needs to be luminal, because only that quantity really determines the speed of information. So just to remind you, everyone knows, here's a little picture for it. There's a wave. The bigger dotted lines are the envelope of the wave. The pink lines are the actual wave. And what the phase velocity, this is the wave snapshot at one time, t is 0, and this is a snapshot at some time like t delta t. And the phase velocity, of course, is just obtained by tracking the actual wave, is the actual velocity of, say, the peak of the wave or the trough, it doesn't really matter. Whereas the group velocity is, roughly speaking, the velocity of the overall envelope. And it's for that reason, because we know that really energy doesn't track with the actual wave, it tracks more or less with the envelope. It's for that reason that we usually tell undergraduates that it is the group velocity that carries the speed of information, because it looks like it's carrying what the actual propagation of the energy. And that's not the case. And the way to think about Sommerfeld's front velocity is what you have to really do is start with nothing. And then you suddenly turn on some instantaneous spike, and you ask at some time later where it's gotten to. And that will be some finite distance away. And that front velocity turns out you can show the very front of that spread of that wave packet from an instantaneous packet to some finite time t delta t later is just the k goes to infinity limit of the phase velocity. So that's why it's called the wavefront or the front velocity. It's literally the front of the excitation. Now, so why is it only the front velocity is important? So rather than giving you the way Sommerfeld would do, I want to give it from the point of view of quantum field theory point of view, because that's really what we're more interested in here. So as everybody knows, in field theory, in a Lorentz invariant field theory, causality and locality are the same thing, and relativistic causality is encoded in the statement that for every pair of operators, or it don't have to be the same ones, but I just wrote the same ones here, those operators commute outside the Lorentz invariant light cone. So that, of course, is the absolute definition of microcausality, and nobody is debating that point. So the question is, what is the conditions necessary for this to be true? So let me, for example, stick ourselves in some, not the vacuum state, because the vacuum, that's all trivially true, right? The vacuum propagator. But let's imagine we're in some non-vacuum state. So we might be thinking a background coherent state or a some excited state, it doesn't really matter, and compute the retarded propagator in that background state. So the retarded propagator is essentially just the commutator times a theta function. So I'm isolating myself to the forward light cone. And if it is true that this thing vanishes outside the Lorentz invariant light cone, then this thing, although it doesn't look Lorentz invariant, will be Lorentz invariant. That's the whole point, that the notion in Lorentz invariant theory, the notion of time ordering is Lorentz invariant. But if this is larger than the Lorentz invariant light cone, then I can always perform a boost so that this thing goes backwards in time. So what I'm going to do is assume that this does vanish outside the light cone, or prove the condition that that has to be true so that this definition is Lorentz invariant modulo the spontaneous breaking by the vacuum. The state that you're evaluating it. So typically, this looks something like, I'm going to keep things simple, but it looks something like this. Because you're not in a vacuum state, you won't have your waves will travel at some non-standard with some non-standard dispersion relation, omega k. Of course, more generally, there's also likely to be some modification of the amplitude, but the argument that I'm going to make could be run with that. But let me just sort of reduce it down to saying, so what we're saying is in this background state, which if you want, you can view as some non-zero background for your field theory, and you're perturbing around that background, in that state, there is some non-standard dispersion relation.
So here you're assuming that all is a free field.
No.
I know.
I'm trying to, the argument I could, yeah, you're right. This particular formula is assuming that, but the general philosophy, one could do better than what I'm going to do, but I'd rather keep it simple. Yeah, but let's imagine, yeah, it's some interacting theory of a scalar field, and I'm just evaluating the two-point function around some background for that. It'll look something like that. It'll also be the normalization of the amplitude, but okay. And also, for simplicity, just to the argument, let me assume the state to be rotationally symmetric so that I can perform all the angular integrals, jiggle it round, and then the retarded propagator will look something like this. And of course, this has the famous I epsilon prescription that gives you the retarded as opposed to the Feynman propagator. So something very familiar to everyone. The only difference from the normal story for propagator in vacuum is that this thing now is generically a function of a non-trivial function of k, which depends on the background alpha that you are expanding around, effectively expanding around. And now let's switch from k to omega by defining the refractive index. And although technically omega is positive, you usually define n at negative real omega to be the same as n at positive omega, and jiggle that into that form. So I haven't really done anything, just change of variables there. And now comes an important point. We're now going to assume that this quantity, the refractive index, which technically was only defined, it started out life only defined on the positive real axis, and then I decided to define it on the negative real axis by mirror image copy. But we're now going to assume that it can be extended to an analytic function in the whole upper half complex plane. And then the fact that that is the case, must be the case, from Titchmarsh's theorem, which is the fact that for any, if you work it the other way around, if I know the retarded propagator, I can do the inverse Fourier transform back to see what this thing looks like. And Titchmarsh's theorem says that any function which vanishes for t less than zero, the Fourier transform of that function will be analytic in the upper half complex omega plane. And therefore, it seems eminently reasonable to assume the refractive index is analytic in the upper half complex omega plane.
I think, in general, it's even more complicated than that. It's really not the refraction index which characterizes what happens, but there is a kernel which depends both on omega and k. There is some analog of this condition for this kernel,
yeah,
which you can't really reformulate just in terms of condition for refraction.
No, of course, but I'm trying to keep it simple. I mean, really, of course, yeah, ultimately, it's you demand analyticity of ultimately the whole S matrix, right? This is I agree with you. This is I'm doing this more for pedagogy than saying that this is not sufficient, but in this particular example, it is sufficient. In this simplistic example.
Sorry, but I'm not right. This complication comes when you demand that something vanishes outside the lifetime rather than just for this world and zero. Whereas here you are still at the stage in which you're saying something vanishes for this world and zero.
That's right. I haven't got to the Lycon thing yet.
In which case, I think you only get an implicit in omega without any...
Yeah, for this problem, yeah. That's right. So from if you gave me this function as a function of t, and it vanishes by construction, I've made it vanish for t less than zero, then there's no question its argument is analytic in the upper half complex plane. Now, and then that, of course, is a crucial point. If it's analytic in the upper half complex plane, I can close the contour in the upper half complex plane, and there's only one pole, and that simple pole just picks yourself out at omega is e plus I epsilon to be pedantic. And so that basically then makes this exponential now into the e to the minus I e t minus n of e r. And physically, that is obviously the right answer. What this is saying is the retarded propagator, as everybody knows, is a superposition of outgoing spherical waves, right? The fact that we get just the t minus rather than the t plus is just, I mean, again, that's causality that we all know that from electromagnetic course, that the retarded propagator should only be made of outgoing spherical waves. And so we see that coming out. So that's good. So far, there's nothing really non-trivial. But remember that the function n of e, we are assuming to be analytic in the upper half complex plane. Now it's a function of e rather than omega, but the same story is true. We can extend it to an analytic function in the upper half complex e plane. And now the point is that if t is less than, so this as it stands, it's now we're in the e plane, and we're integrating all the way along here. We know the refractive index here, and we assume it's analytic out here. And so what we want to do is, again, close the contour, the E contour, in the upper half complex energy plane. But we can only do that if t is less than n at infinity r, because obviously if t is greater than that, when I add plus I epsilon plus I something to that, this thing is going to blow up. And so in order to be in the region where I can make E into the complex upper half complex energy plane, I need to be at t less than n at infinity r. And it's only n at infinity that matters because it's about closing the contour at infinity, right? I'm not closing the contour here. I'm closing the contour at infinity so that I only require n of infinity t to be less than n at infinity. And that's really the crucial point. So then I can close the contour again like I did before, but now you see in this integral, there's no pole. So if t...
Yeah. For complex E, that inequality becomes tricky now because n at infinity now is going to be an imaginary part in general, depending on where infinity is. So
that's right. So it's real on the real axis, but yeah, it might be. That's right.
You're excluding the possibility of the infinite derivative of the entire function.
Yeah, but let me just stick with this example. I'm just working with a simple example. Yeah, this is just the standard argument, so I'm not saying anything surprising. So if you then close the contour at infinity, then the point is that there's no pole, there's no branch cut, because we have assumed or derived, if you want, that the refractive index was analytic in the upper half plane. Which means that the answer is zero. And we know the answer was zero for t less than zero because we made it true. And now we see that it's also zero for t less than n at infinity r. And therefore, it vanishes outside the light cone divided by t is larger than n at infinity r. And so that prompts the definition, n at infinity. Remember the phase velocity is just 1 over n. And so 1 over n at infinity is the front velocity. And for this light cone of this propagator in this background to remain within the Lorentz invariant light cone, which we would like to do to say that we're preserving microcausality in this Lorentz invariant theory, then the front velocity The only condition, well, the condition is that the front velocity has to be less than or equal to 1. So there was two assumptions in that proof. The analyticity of the refractive index, although at some level there was an assumption here because we could derive it by Titchmarsh theorem, and the front velocity being luminal. And those then imply that in that state we chose, but of course that state was arbitrary, so one could run the argument for a generic state, although the form of the retard propagator would be slightly more complicated, but one could in principle run the argument for a more generic state and argue that this thing then is automatically zero for arbitrary states outside the light cone, as long as the front velocity for the fluctuations around every background in that theory is subluminal. And notice that the group velocity doesn't even come into this discussion. So the one thing we know for sure is the group velocity has nothing to do with the speed of propagation of information. It's the phase velocity at infinity.
So this discussion was for translation invariant backgrounds, right?
I'd have to think about that. One could run an analogous argument, but I think the point is that even for a translation invariant state in the high K regime, if I just look in the high K limit, I'm in the WKB limit, then I don't care that the background is time dependent. And I would still have to have that property being true. So whilst it may not be sufficient, I would say this condition is necessary.
No, that's agreement. No, my question is, does this imply? Because it sounds like you're saying this is...
Yeah, I'm not giving you a rigorous proof this is true. All I want to make clear is that the only thing that comes in this, the only condition on the dispersion relation is this one. That's all I want to make. Yep.
So this is exactly the character speed that comes from the characteristic.
That's right. I'll get to that. Certainly would not dispute that fact.
In fact, isn't this what Johnson and Sudarshan did originally for Valentine's?
That's right. Now I'll get to that point about that discussion.
100 years ago, though, the paper is 61. This is 1915 or something.
Yeah.
Sommerfeld.
They were doing quantum.
That doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah. It's the same calculation. Anyway, we'll get to that. So there is a point where you'll be able to shout at me, but now I'm just reviewing the standard stuff known to everybody that attended a conference in which Sommerfeld was in. okay. Now, of course, the issue is that the front velocity is sensitive to high k, because it is the limit k goes to infinity, and that's the really issue. So does that mean we need to know something about the UV completion in order to determine the low energy physics, like how fast the pion propagates? And I would say no, at least as long as you're asking a truly low energy question. And so let me explain what I mean by that. So take two theories, one whose dispersion relation is exactly this, in which V is larger than 1. And I'll just give it, I'm not going to work with the Galenes and stuff, just let's give it non-derivative interactions, so there's no question about what the propagator is. And another one for which this is true at small k, so that it has the same dispersion relation at low k, but it goes to C at high k for k larger than some scale. Okay, so I could do that. This looks ugly, but just to give you an example, I can write down this ugly-looking Lagrangian. We can imagine, of course, this breaks Lorentz invariance, but we can imagine this having arisen for perturbations around some background which spontaneously breaks Lorentz invariance. For example, I could stick this in the effective field theory of inflation and use the inflaton as a clock and write this down for some fluctuation, which is not the inflaton as some, or their usual blah, blah, blah. But these two theories, right, are indistinguishable at low energies. Right, this obvious by looking at it, if I've done it correctly, I've set it up so that at low energy, at low momenta, I should say, and remember that because this story is only ever true when you're on a background, so you have to spontaneously broke Lorentz invariance, that means there's always a preferred frame, so then there's no ambiguity about what I'm talking about, the momenta in that particular case. So when k is small, I've set it up so that this thing gives you 1/1 v squared, which is v squared, and when k is large, this thing goes to infinity, and this is 1. And this particular toy crappy theory has no ghosts and no other instabilities and so on. It's a perfectly stable field theory. And as long as I don't add derivative interactions, there's no question that this thing determines the causal structure. So these, but the point is that if I do any kind of S matrix or something in which I only send in incoming states whose momenta in relative to the background, spontaneously broken background frame, is much smaller than lambda over V, then there will be no distinction between these two theories. I mean, but the distinction will be suppressed by powers of K V over lambda. Okay, so they're basically the low energy effective field theory of these two things are equivalent. Only their high energy is equivalent.
Your V is smaller than one or larger than one?
Larger than one.
So you're saying that you do need to know the completion to understand whether you're propagating information supercomputing or not.
Right. What I'm saying is if I ask a low energy question, so if I send in only states built out of low momenta particles, I certainly do not need to know that there's a difference between this and this.
Yeah, but
and that is then not sensitive to that answer.
He didn't say that. There is still a way to understand whether it's bad or not in low energy theory, but what he's saying is that just from that characteristic argument, you cannot claim that. That's what he's saying.
Right. So if you did the characteristic of this, it would be superluminal. The characteristics of this are luminal, but these theories are indistinguishable in the low energy physics. That's the point.
So, but the second theory, I think the second theory is subluminal?
Yeah, I made it so. If I do the characteristic analysis of this, then I take the limit where the derivatives go to infinity. Right? That's how it's done. It's essentially the k is infinity limit, which is why the characteristic analysis picks out the front velocity.
And your problem is the same, which is a bit confusing. I don't think it's enough to talk about just purely Green's functions. Probably to say that we address low k physics, you need to say what are the frequencies in your source.
Yeah, let me just think about scattering, right? Then all I'm saying is that any scattering matrix element in which the initial momenta are smaller than this is indistinguishable.
It doesn't even make sense. It's a sign there is this minus p squared plus lambda squared in the denominator.
So there's a minus there, okay. minus here, yeah. Sorry, I forgot to put the signs in. You're right.
We can discuss it later, but let's ignore interactions. Let's just look at the level of Priest theory. I would think that for any theory, so basically, the time of the propagating will be non-zero everywhere outside light cost for this theory.
This one?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
So
that's my point.
Non-zero.
No, it's zero. It's zero. It's zero by the previous argument. No, that's zero.
Yeah.
That's zero. That has the front velocity unity. So by that argument.
Front velocity is a necessary condition. But what you really have to do, you need to calculate retarded propagator.
Yes. Let me ignore the interactions. The retarded propagator of this is by construction zero outside the light cone.
Yes.
Yeah.
For this
particular retarded propagator is precisely fits into the example that I just gave you the argument
because
for. Let's talk later, but it might be that for the issues you're worrying about, I have to be more sophisticated. But I think the point I'm getting at is that.
Can you really calculate the retarded propagator or just check the front velocity?
Well, this the retarded propagator, that's easy to do, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Okay,
my claim would be it will be non zero everywhere outside light cone.
Okay, I would say it's zero outside light cone.
But isn't it bad?
Wait, pardon? Did you do calculation of. What you're saying is based on front velocity or on calculation?
let's talk later.
let me ask you, sorry, the issue about the front velocity, anyway, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition.
That's right. But the failure of it not being sufficient has more to do with the analyticity than the dispersion relation.
We should discuss it later, but I think with Alberto we proved that if you have kernel of the form omega squared minus f of k, the only case when you can well define light cone is f of k quadratic polynomial in k. For all other cases, you will have the retarded propagator will be not zero everywhere outside light cone.
Yeah, that I don't agree with.
And that's really irrelevant.
But you know why where his argument comes? Because you would say that.
But he didn't calculate, right?
But he said that.
No, I gave you the. I gave you.
Analyticity and his front velocity.
Yeah. Okay, so we could talk. I'd have to see your example to know.
You should say where it goes wrong, because if I take now the group, the packet, applying this return to Green's function, that will be transmission of information. So then, what does it go wrong according to you? That argument.
But
so you're saying if I take a packet, wave packet,
right.
and I want to understand its evolution,
right?
I will do that according to the retarded Green's function that Andrew just calculated. So according to you, where did calculation go?
I mean, you're differentiating between the f of k's with the k squared. You're saying we the calculation we saw that the k squared is the only one.
Right.
And he's saying that the only thing that matters is k going to infinity, not k
right.
going to infinity,
right.
I get k squared.
Yeah, I gave you the argument for vanishing outside the light
okay,
curve.
Okay, so for instance, can I point out the subject in the time
you okay.
do n of e, etc.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
When you write that thing. So, again, so in the complex E plane, what's at the exponent as E and V also as a coefficient of R, no? And so E times N of V. So R multiplies
okay.
E times N of V.
Oh, that's right.
So for complex E, you have to take a real part there. And so the condition you write down there, T is smaller than N V R,
right.
should involve some real parts depending on how you approach the
I think we're also assuming and I didn't say it because I was just trying to be simple, but maybe that's my fault. We're also assuming that this thing is analytic in the upper half complex energy plane, so that this particular combination is also the case. That requires that's a stronger condition.
Sorry, but if n is analytic, that's analytic.
Yeah.
If n is analytic.
But by analytic, we also mean going to zero to infinity, right? It's more different people use different definitions of analyticity.
But
by analyticity, we mean not going.
N, right? Because it's not of the form k squared equal omega squared times n of omega. It's the form omega squared equal f of k. And these are two very different situations. So. I'm not sure
what that difference is only in the normalization of the amplitude here.
There's a
prefactor.
Difference.
Yeah.
No,
oh, no,
no,
that, that I agree with. So in that case, I would have to also make sure that what sits in front of here is analytic. So I would simply counter that I can easily adjust that by modifying the function of k in front of here and here to make that true. I see no mathematical reason why that's not possible.
There's a huge difference between writing something pi dot squared minus f of k and writing dispersion relation n of omega, like omega n of omega equal k. In the first case,
yeah.
you're guaranteed always to have causality. In this,
right.
In the second case, there are this Kramers-Kronig relation, so it's not trivial to get even causality.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So maybe this was being too naive. What I'm really saying is that I should have no trouble writing two functions omega in front of here, such that the refractive index and the amplitude are analytic in the upper half complex plane.
And with that, perhaps we agree.
No, with
and
that,
then,
we can agree.
Yeah.
But I would say there is also.
I'm sure you agree.
To check this because I still.
Yeah.
I
see.
You have no trouble to check in low energy effective field theory whether your retarded propagator is zero or not zero outside light curve.
Yeah. I see your point, but I think it's sort of.
I think in a situation like that, when you have. At k equal to zero, we have phase velocity which is larger than one, and that's your dispersion relation. But that means that you have really superluminal propagation, in the sense that the retarded propagator is non-zero outside light curve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm never going to talk about something where there's information outside the light cone. Okay. So moving on from that point. To answer Sommerfeld's question, which is where you then have an instantaneous front and you look at it propagating, the point is that this particular question, why it depends on the front velocity, is because in order to create this thing in the first place, I need to construct my initial wave packet to be made out of modes of arbitrarily high momenta, which means that generally that's going to include modes which sit above the cutoff lambda that distinguishes these two particular low energy effective field theories. And this relates to what Gregory was saying, is can you actually construct a wave packet which goes subluminally, and that wave packet is itself sitting in the regime of ability, the low entropy field theorem. So, so I would say, modulo this particular discussion, if I've given you an answer where this is truly has satisfies the requirement I said, then these theories are indistinguishable in the low energy effective field theory, but this is certainly a causal, and this, if I've constructed it correctly, is causal. And yet they will be indistinguishable for any low energy question in which I only my initial state is only built out of modes whose momenta is lower than lambda over
v. Because this front velocity is, you define it as a necessary condition. It's a very hard object to calculate in effective field theory.
Right.
But so let's forget about it. So let's not talk about velocities at all. Let's just calculate the initial object, to the commutator, retarded propagator.
Yeah.
And you can do it with an effective field theory. If you get it's non-zero,
no.
It's not zero.
No, that I don't agree with. That I don't agree with. Because these two these two things that's equivalent in low energy effective field theory.
No, I think that this example is just wrong.
I disagree with that. No.
Well, we should settle.
Yeah. Let's talk later because.
But you disagree that one can calculate 2-point function within effective field theory at low energy?
Not at all. You can do that. Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that. Now, if you have your kernel like this with asymptotics at low k with v larger than 1. At long distances, what matters only is that low k.
Yeah, the point. I can do this calculation, but in a low energy effective field theory, this calculation is not the relevant thing. I need to send in an initial wave packet and perform the integral over that, and then ask for my initial wave packet.
No, sorry. You need to calculate commutator of two.
Yeah, that I've computed, right?
And to check whether it's 0 or 0, you don't need to send this shit.
No, that's the point.
Right?
The initial, you have to actually construct an initial state and look at how that state propagates, and the initial state has to be only made out of low energy modes.
You need to calculate OX, OY, right? Outside light pole.
Once you have the operators,
again,
you don't need to calculate
any
commutator of two operators. Propagate anything else, meaning
no, 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 yeah, but you're missing the point. That if my UV completion of my particular theory is luminal, then the retarded propagator will vanish outside the light cone. But I need to ask the distinction between these two theories with a question that I can construct. I have to send in a wave packet which is built out of only modes built out of momenta, which are in the regime of validity of the low energy effective field theory.
Probably what you mean is not actually the wave pocket which you want to produce, but you mean a test function which creates out of this distributive operator.
Same story, yes.
And that's, of course, that's a different thing. But by the way, this thing will also look different if you try to interpret this to series in different frames. Not in preferred frame like this, but if you do a boost, which, of course, you're not allowed to do because there is no symmetry anymore. But nevertheless, you could try to fly through this medium.
Right, but if the UV completion is Ranson invariant, then the thing will still vanish outside the light cone, regardless of how I boost it.
But then I'm not sure about the analytic properties, effects of pulse, and you think, because of the complicated structure of this
The point is that this question, whilst I can calculate in the low energy effective field theory, is not a low energy effective field theory question.
We agreed from the very beginning that the right thing to look at the commutator of two operators outside light cone.
If I can calculate it, I'm not saying that's not the answer.
Let's calculate that with an effective field theory. We can do
it. What I'm saying.
And after you did and get non-zero answer, if it's large enough, you know the correction is not spoiled. You don't need to regress it with any wave packet.
No. You have to ask a physical question.
No. So sorry. Did you agree that the condition that operators should send you outside the light cone?
You have a little bit of terminology different. Because when Andrew says calculate retarded function, he implies calculate through the way that he described in terms of asymptotic behavior of the contours at infinity, which include this large k behavior. But I think what you are talking about, calculation within low energy.
And in low energy effective field theory, I just want to calculate 2-point function. I don't need to dress
it. My point is, if that vanishes, if that is non-zero outside the light cone, I don't regard that as a violation of causality.
Oh, but you started with because defining that that's my
no,
causality,
no.
Right?
The real retarded propagator, if that vanishes, is non-zero outside the light cone, yeah. Then there's
okay,
no question.
The
point is the difference between your a causal one and the causal one is negligible, provided you ask that you construct the initial state to be only made out of modes which are built, which are in the low energy effective field
but
theory.
But perhaps we even disagree with this statement in the sense that we are not sure we agree with this example because of the
variation.
But that's another story. I think that's
well, that's important, right? So because
No. But that's another story. I think you agree on the general point that I could have.
I also agree on the general point.
No. Well, you agree on.
I'm neutral. So I think the disagreement is that you are saying that if the front velocity is one, then method two, the propagator is zero outside the light cone.
No. You're taking me slightly the wrong way. So what I'm telling you, let's forget it. Maybe these examples have led you off in the wrong direction. What I'm saying is I've got one theory and two theory. Now, what I'm saying is that there's no difficulty having two theories whose low energy effective field theory looks identical, but the one of which is UV completion is lens invariant in the sense that it's all its commutators vanish at the light cone, and the other one is not. Right?
The question is, how do you define identical? So you seem to
right. Identical. Identical in a low energy effective field theory has to be asked between momenta states, not position states. So the point is that this is not the right question. You actually have to construct initial states built out of only modes which are in the regime of validity. That's the point.
No, because that is your initial definition, right?
No, no. My initial, I was talking about the true God-given retarded propagator.
No, you're talking about two-point function of operators. And in field theory, okay, endpoint function is that our observables, we're calculating them. Effective field theory is calculated, the tool to calculate them perturbatively, right? So
yeah.
If you calculate it perturbatively, at large separation, got a zero answer.
What I'm saying is that the momenta space retarded propagator are indistinguishable at low energies.
No, let's calculate position space retarded.
Yeah, but going to,
right?
Going,
you can, once you have, if you have.
No, but going to position space requires including modes above the cutoff.
I mean, you are magically selecting the momentum eigenspace, and for some reason that I have no idea what it is, you think that it's better than position space.
Yes.
Now, right? I have not the faintest idea why you do that. You could take the way in which you would approximate the theory of low energy would be to say, well, let's smear an operator here with a wave function that is big or a test function that is larger than the cutoff, right? Let's smear another operator on Mars with that function, which is 1 meter wide. I mean, if the commutator of these two is not zero, then the theory is sick. I mean, you don't need to go to momentum space, impose a
that's right.
Cutoff on momentum space.
If it's true for the actual retarded propagator, then the theory is sick, absolutely. I'm not disputing that fact.
Well, the commutator, because that's the thing that you're computing in field theory, right? In quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, when you look at causality, it's really the offshore commutator. It's not the retarded propagator.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Not a complaint, just a question. So, so in theory two, if I expand that second term in powers of gradients,
yeah.
Okay, so I get now higher order operators which are not there in theory one.
That's
so
right.
It's still true that in perturbation theory, within the regime of validity of the effective theory, the two retarded operators are different.
That's right. What I meant is they approximately the same. So I'll get to that point. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think for me the theory is this. Or whatever the corrected version of this is that solves your
no
problem, right? What I'm this is not the theory because you can't always tell the difference. I agree. So for me, the actual theory is this, and the actual retarded propagator vanishes outside the light cone. What I'm saying is, if you forgot to include those corrections, which do exist, then you would conclude that the velocity was superlinear.
So you're saying effective field theory is not a good tool at all, right?
No, I'm saying it's absolutely a good tool for any question that is in the regime.
It's a long distance observable. I don't need to talk about momentum space at all. I can do every single, all my perturbations here in position space, right? And I want to just calculate long distance correlator of people doing condensed matter. They never create any history. They look at position space, right? And I calculate my correlator. I found that it's not zero. Well, and it's I found something large, so I don't expect large current now. It's it's an answer which is not zero, like this naive dimensional analysis, higher order corrections would take the zero to non-zero. Now we're saying, oh, there is some mysterious UV completion which would make the zero turn the zero to non-zero into zero. Well,
right.
It's equivalent to say that the effective field theory is useless, right?
No, no, not useless. Not useless.
I don't think he's saying that.
I'm not saying it's useless. Yeah. Yeah. I'm basically, I mean, I'm formalizing a similar statement to what Gregory was saying about constructing wave packets.
To calculate long distance behavior of the two-point function, it's enough to know the zero omega and k limit of my propagator. I calculated it and found that it's not zero outside light cone. So.
Yeah.
So
I think.
Why don't we let him?
Yeah. So my point, my point is that this is not the actual theory. The actual theory is something like that, right?
There's just an issue here. The famous fine-tuning problem of the Higgs mass.
Oh no! Come on, that's not an issue.
Start doing quantum corrections, it become uncontrollable, and you start getting into trouble with your non-UV complete theory. So your statement that it's just low energies.
Yeah, that issue is about the cutoff scale lambda. So there is a cutoff, the effective field theory breaks down. So so I've given you the story about the front velocity, but there's a criticism of that, which uses the fact, so the phase velocity is given by this, and then normally one derives the Kramers-Kronig dispersion relations from analyticity, which relate the real and imaginary parts. And normally one also finds from unitarity that the imaginary part of the refractive index has to be positive. And if you put these different states together, if this thing is positive, this integral is positive, that tells you that this thing is less than that, which translated into phase velocity tells you phase velocity is infinity, has to be larger than phase velocity at zero. But that means if this front velocity is indeed luminal, that means that the phase velocity at all lower energies has to be subluminal, which means that if these steps were true, then any observation of superluminal phase velocity at low energies would violate the front velocity or one of these assumptions. Yet superluminal phase velocities at low energies are indeed actually observed, and there are many different experiments. So here's a recent one from people at Geneva, and they look at the direct measurement of the group velocity and phase velocity in an optical fiber. And concretely, they show the experiment shows that the group velocity can exceed C and also the phase velocity, although they emphasize the group. And we report the first direct observation, the so-called signal velocity, which is the front, which is basically another name for the front velocity, the speed at which information propagates, and it cannot be faster than C. And here's the basic, this is a map of the experiment. These are two point beam splitters. And here is the refractive index, which they just measure. And the refractive index goes up and down, which means it's violating Kramer's Kronig. And here, what they basically do is they send in, have a wave packet, send it through this system, look at it at a later time, and then infer the speed of this thing. And so what's happening, let me draw you a picture of what superluminal low energy phase velocity looks like without contradicting causality. So let me draw you a plot where we have along each line, this is one light second, two light seconds, three light seconds, four light seconds, etc. And you take some kind of packet like this, like that, at one time, and you ask, what does that look like at a later time? Well, what happens is that the front velocity here, you see, never goes beyond. This is the dotted line is the initial packet. The experimental line here is the packet observed at a later time. And you see that the packet observed at a later time never goes beyond the 1 second mark at each one. So the actual front velocity, which is the velocity of the leading part of the wave packet, is luminal. What little peak?
The green.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
It's
I'm not an experimentalist. I'm sure they understood what they were doing.
If it doesn't fit your model, then you dismiss it.
Right? Yeah. I'm sure they understood what they were doing. What happens is this. So what you see is that the packet gets scrunched up. So the group velocity, which basically, an inside by packet here we mean this is really the wave. Yeah, there they are. So the group velocity, which is basically the speed of the peak of the packet, is going faster than the speed of light, and the phase velocity also goes faster than the speed of light. And the refractive index gets bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller. But nevertheless, the front velocity is luminal. And that's what they directly measure that.
My recollection that this crucial whole system like that there is also like a imaginary part of the refraction index. And that was actually responsible for this.
Sure.
What happens here that little wave, the tail of the wave packet enters and triggers some kind of, you can call it instability. Yeah. That's why the
That's right. That's right. But all these things are occurring on backgrounds in which there is going to be some instability.
But again, in that example that you were showing before, there was no imaginary part in the.
Okay. I regret. I was trying to keep it simple, but yeah, I understand your point. Yeah.
No, but I think that's crucial. So if you have this personal relation omega equal vk without any imaginary parts of the energies, then nothing like that would save you.
Right.
And then really, group velocity, phase velocity, they're all the same thing and they respond to signal propagation.
Right.
So it's crucial here that there is a very imaginary part of this relation.
I'm not disputing that, yeah. Yeah. But that's true in all these cases because we're looking around a background which is going to have some it'll decay, right? So.
And you're saying in these examples they are sort of wrong sign imaginary parts and they don't respond to absorption,
but
that's what's called inverse population. That's what's called inverse population.
Right.
I think there is a very good discussion on the PhD father by Linde Fusion. He is exactly discussing the spectrums and instabilities and why these packets look like they propagate faster, but they don't propagate, they are just creating instability, which is growing there.
Right.
So Andrew, you said it violates Cramer's chronic, so I missed that. You said there's something because this N is oscillating.
That's right. He's explicitly violating the Cramer's chronic, yeah.
In what sense? What is it that?
Cramer's chronic requires that the n always increases or decreases, whichever one it is.
Okay.
If this is positive, then this thing has to decrease.
That's because the imaginary part is negative.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
so it's
right.
Already
violating.
Yes, it's not violating the mathematical formula. It's violating what people would normally regard as a consequence. Yes. Yeah. It's wording. So indeed, one of these things has to break, and the thing that breaks is this thing already breaks, the imaginary part becomes negative. And this has some similarity with examples that we've already heard about, and I think we'll hear tomorrow, for QED on curved space-time, where depending on the backgrounds you choose, you can violate the imaginary part. And
actually,
like.
That's not the answer.
Okay, I know there were various versions of the answer, but anyway.
So what happens is that analytically,
okay, yeah, so it's this one. So usually, in these examples, one of these things goes, but not this one. Agree with that?
That's right.
Yeah, okay, there we go.
It's just QED.
So I would claim that in the case of things like Galileans and massive gravity, whilst it is true that classically the characteristic analysis gives the front signal velocity, I would say that doesn't. We don't really know that to be true, and let me skip ahead actually and explain what I mean by that. So when we write down the theory of massive gravity, say as an example, or Galileans, we wrote down this theory, and you make a big fuss that it's ghost-free. But really, that's a silly thing to make a big fuss about, or at least it could be a silly thing. Depends on your perspective. Because we know that this theory, perturbation theory, breaks down at this low energy scale. And if you take the point of view that that scale is the cutoff of the effective field theory, then there's absolutely no reason to write down only these terms. This is really the crucial point. Because then...
It's not a silly thing. I'm sorry.
Pardon?
It's not a silly thing.
What's not a silly thing?
What you said. So the loss freedom and low energies is important.
It's important for the Weinstein.
For
no. Wait a second. No. I know it's important for you and me, but
what I'm saying is if you have a ghost at scale which is a million times less than lambda 3, that's fine.
Oh, of course not. No. Yeah. No. Okay. Sorry.
So you may not break down and still have a ghost.
No, but I think
I think maybe we should finish your statement.
Yeah, sorry, I was too quick with the statement. Once you have demonstrated that there is no ghost below lambda 3, which you can do already in the decoupling limit, and that is what fixed that theory, asking the absence of ghosts beyond that scale is somewhat fishy, right? It depends on what you think is happening next. Because we know that perturbation theory breaks down that scale, if you want to say that's the cutoff of the effective field theory, then it is not possible really to consider those terms in the Lagrangian beyond that. And one would have to add all those infinite number of terms, of which these are just a set of terms that are wrote down schematically in the effective field theory sense. I've written them out in terms of k. And the fact that these terms arise just comes from the fact that in the decoupling limit, the point is in the Galilean, the scale lambda 3 is what you see already in the decoupling limit. The decoupling limit k mu nu is the Galilean invariant combination, once canonically normalized to this guy. And I'm simply writing down the infinite number of possible Galilean invariant combinations that you would construct, that you would expect to generate in a low-energy effective field theory sense.
Andrew?
Yes?
Is that also the scalar invariant theory?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. What? What are you shaking your head at?
No, I mean, what is implying?
Oh, it's a combination. It depends on if there's a hierarchy between the scales. It's determined by the lower Planck scale. In general, it's a funny combination of the two M Plancks, and N.
Known combination.
Yeah, it's known. Yeah, I can work it out for you.
What happens to your elasticity if you have an infinite number of terms?
Well, that's the point, right? So all we have here is a low energy effective field theory.
You can't close the
right.
You have an entire function.
So I don't know what this is. I've got no idea. Right?
Silly question to ask. In
the point I'm getting across is that this is not the theory necessarily. Right? One should not take this theory so seriously because we know that it breaks down perturbatively at some scale, and you have to say something about what happens above that scale. That's the point. We don't know. I agree we don't know. But my point is that if I took this theory, which is what the actual theory will be, or something like that, so it may be that there's some arguments that suggest that the actual scale can be higher, and certainly so there's an argument in the background that the effective cutoff is higher and blah, blah, blah. I won't go into that because that's a different story, but let's just take the naive effective field theory story, which is this one. The point is that this is the actual theory. This is what we really mean. Not this thing. And the actual theory, if you do a characteristic analysis, then of course you'll get a completely different answer because you're always sensitive to the higher derivatives. That's the point. So that is why we don't really take too much, we don't have too much concern with the characteristic analysis of this Lagrangian. Because we know I can just do a calculation of one loop, there are calculable corrections to the characteristic analysis formula, which around a given background will come in at a scale which depends on lambda and that background, which will modify the formula for the dispersion relation at some large k, which depends on that background, it depends on lambda. And therefore, I cannot trust the characteristic analysis or the front velocity formula I would infer from this. We don't know that it becomes non-local.
It does.
I haven't got entire functions.
Are you taking an infinite derivative or truncated?
Yeah, this is just standalone effective field theory story. This could have come out from integrating out local physics. There's a whole other story I don't want to get into, but yeah. Right? The point is I can actually do the one loop calculation to this thing, find stuff that looks like this. I can then look at the one-loop corrections to the dispersion relation around that given background that gave you superluminality, and I have calculable corrections that tell me the front velocity differs by a large amount at high k. That's the point. So I don't know how you can trust the characteristic analysis of this thing.
From this point of view, basically all this calculation would be irrelevant because anyway, this is a low exactly. energy or something, and then it's something, and then
exactly, exactly. It's all irrelevant. If you had a renormalizable field theory, right, then the characteristic analysis makes sense. Exactly. And the point is, all these theories are coming from gravity theories, and that's the yeah. These are non-renormalizable theories. No. The long distance 2-point function, when I add this piece in, will be significantly different if I choose my initial wave packet to be built. No, not at all. Exactly opposite. If you, I'm not. Effective field theory is not useless.
No, but that's not effective field theory. Effective field theory is to calculate correlators at long distances.
I'm going
to
say
without knowing UV completion. So you are claiming that's impossible to do.
There is a way within the low energy theory to understand whether it is a causal or not within the low energy theory. But looking at the characteristics in classical theory is not the answer.
I'm not talking about characteristics.
That's what he's talking about.
I'm saying if you ask a low energy question, low energy effective field theory gives you the answer. That's
It's enough to calculate correlated low distance. 2-point function.
In the low energy.
Without any dressing with
in the low energy effective field theory, no.
So you mean that exactly the thing that was used to compute. Effective field theory was created to compute long distance correlators, right?
Yeah.
And you say, no, distance cannot compute it. So when I have a lattice, a critical point, and I use a conformal field theory or a low energy approximation or a continuum limit, I cannot compute correlators in lattice field theory at distances much larger than the lattice. Is that what you are saying?
No. I don't know.
Then you can compute smear correlators at long distance.
I can compute, right? I compute low energy observables.
They are reliable.
If I may make one comment, maybe what Andrew means is that when he talks about calculation of those things, which calculation in a way that he described, which involves the contour at infinity, which assumes these large K modes.
That's right.
Normally, when we say we calculate the low energy theory, we mean that we only take modes of low energy theory, and then we do calculations which are different from those calculations. I think that might be the question of disagreement.
Yeah, I think we're disagreeing on terminology.
I don't think we disagree, on the semantics. So, because your point is that if you take like a Galilean theory in which we would claim that there is superluminarity and the theory is not consistent, on the other hand, you are saying if you don't tell me the derivative terms, I cannot do the calculation.
I'm saying if you want to calculate the dispersion relation. Yeah.
So
around the background.
Can we calculate 2-point function without knowing the CNs? That's the question. No matter whatever way, was that characteristics or just function? Can you reliably calculate an effective theory without knowing all the high derivative terms, 2-point function at long distances?
Up to certain approximation, while it's really lower in the theory, yes.
Right, okay. Correct. Yes. And if you get non-zero outside that form, it is not zero.
Light form defined again. Up to certain approximations.
Yes.
Beyond land.
Yeah. My criticism, as it were, is against the classical characteristic analysis. Right.
This is a different point.
But this characteristic analysis is just a way to calculate. In fact, the field theory calculates the problem.
Let's just forget about that. I'm saying if you want to compute the dispersion relation. I can compute the one loop. I can compute the corrections from this to the dispersion relation,
right.
And they come in at high k. You agree with that, right?
That's fine, but high k that's irrelevant for long distance correlator. That's the whole point.
Right, but the front velocity, the characteristic analysis, which is giving you that front velocity, is obtained by taking a high k limit.
No, but you do two steps. First, you want to calculate long distance correlator and effective field theory. So for that, you reduce the effective field theory. Now you're left with math problem, not physics problem. And it's convenient to solve this mass problem using characteristic analysis with the kernel which you have in effective field theory. But you don't need to do that.
If you've done a computation.
That's
an example of QED framework that So characteristics of low energies are super luminous, right?
Well, that's not translation invariant, right? Again, you really need to calculate, so in that example, you really need to calculate commutator outside line column, and you find that it's zero.
Yeah, but that's a different calculation from characteristics.
No, in that particular case, it's
well,
the same.
Well, but he's talking about Galileans in which those are not homogeneous.
Yeah, I'm talking about backgrounds in which the translation invariance is broken, just the same.
No, for it's not broken.
No. I'm talking about around backgrounds in which translation invariance is broken.
Because there's a Galilean symmetry.
It's exactly the same. Yeah. Translation invariance is spontaneously broken. So, yeah, what I'm saying is if you want to know the dispersion relation at high k, you need to include these corrections. I mean, I can calculate the bloody things and I get a correction.
I think these we all agree.
Right. Right. Okay. Good. Not everybody agrees on that point. So that's the there.
Everybody agrees on that. I think also everybody should agree that this high k limit of dispersion relation is irrelevant for long distance behavior of the propagator. Do you agree on that or not?
No.
But that means when you say that the perfect series is useless.
No.
I think he's talking about this fine point. How about maybe we should let him talk about this fine point and see what it means?
Yeah.
Are you talking about fine points?
Yeah. Can I have a different question? Yeah, sure.
What I want to ask you, what is the relevance of this stuff to something like massive gravity? So what you said, of course, makes very much sense in a theory or a single matrix and proper Lorentz invariants. Now, in a theory like massive gravity, by matrix theory, you have two matrices.
Yeah.
So in general, the notion of light cone is not even well defined.
That's right.
So now take a situation where you have these two matrices, but you always have an effective light cone which includes both or whatever light cones you have. So suppose in a theory you always have a well-defined time direction and a well-defined hypersurface, spatial hypersurface, on which you can specify initial data, then your differential equation will give you proper evolution of initial data in time.
Right.
You don't have a standard light cone like in ordinary GR, for example. Your velocities are larger than some light cones, smaller than some other light cones.
That's right.
They are within a kinetic light cone. So in that case, you would expect that the problem is completely well-defined. As long as they have a proper time direction in a hypersurface on which you can specify initial data.
Right. I mean, I think there are people in the audience who would disagree it's well defined, but I agree with you. I mean, in that case, there's an effective metric, and things can be causal with respect to that metric.
So then, if I took any one of the matrix, any one of the individual matrix in that problem, I could get superluminal propagation with respect to that matrix. And from the point of view of this discussion, I may be in trouble. But the evolution problem is completely well defined. Just take the theory with two matrices, or one matrix and a background matrix. Yes.
I agree.
So if you get, just trying to understand, if you have a situation where your differential equation with a unique time direction, or a common time direction, under a hypersurface, the initial value problem is well defined, you can specify initial data and you have proper time
direction. Yeah, and then just set up current tables there, and that's your theory, and get what you get. You may not be happy with it when you capitalize to other things.
Wouldn't life be easier if the graviton was massive?
Life would be easier if there were no gravity. All right, let me go, because I had other things to say, but those are the simple things. So I think as many people know this, we don't even need to go to Galileo's mass of gravity. It's easy to give an example in Proker theory, where you add in, say, an a to the 4 in that, and you can do a characteristic analysis. And indeed, there are points in the characteristic analysis in which you you get the you can get superluminal, or you can get going over to the point at which it looks like you can create a closed time-like curve, and everybody knows about that, and that's sort of analogous to the Veloz-Wanziger thing. But in fact, all this could already precisely this fact can already be seen in the decoupling limit of this particular theory, just as all the all the superluminal solutions found in massive gravity are actually already there present in the decoupling limit. And here, the decoupling limit you take, you introduce the broken U1 gauge invariance, but you have to canonically normalize it with the M. And then you derive the decoupling limit theory, and it looks like this. But in the decoupling limit, you send M to 0, but you have to take lambda over M to the 4 fixed. And that's the decoupling limit theory, and it's like a P of X type model. And as most of us know, for a P of X model, there's an effective metric for that particular theory, which depends on the background. And that effective metric, again, is precisely what comes in the characteristic analysis. So the two things, if you take the decoupling limit of the quantity that comes in the characteristic analysis formula, is precisely the effective metric of the Liszt zero mode. And what you see is precisely those points at which the evolution becomes pathological is where the Z00 for that effective metric hits zero, which means that the fluctuations around that solution become infinitely strongly coupled at that point. And so that's also what we mean is that in these theories, if you try and construct a closed time-like curve by basically turning over from the point where the characteristics go time-like, and you do a boost, you try and construct a closed time-like curve, it's always true that in order to form the closed time-like curves in these theories, what happens is the Liszt zero mode becomes infinitely strongly coupled, and so you can't trust the classical solution that would do that. Okay.
Is it only the Liszt zero mode that operates superluminally?
The original. In the decoupling limit, it is.
Oh, away from the decoupling.
Well, away from decoupling, everybody mixes, so no. So yeah.
But what is this example supposed to illustrate? So is this healthy series the UV completion for this theory?
Of course, you need a UV completion. Yes.
This is
not a healthy. Remember, I'm reviewing here, so I was hoping to also review those arguments. So this is but the point I want to make here is that what is transparent is if you take that theory seriously, this exactly copies what happens in massive gravity and Galileans in general. If you take the theory seriously, of course its characteristic analysis fails, but wherever its characteristic analysis fails is also where the Liszt zero mode becomes infinitely strongly coupled, and the same is true in the case of massive gravity. And so that's why the point is we say we can't trust the classical theory there because the fluctuations are infinitely strongly coupled around that.
How is it different from saying that we don't know how to deal with the ground with closed time like curves? So when you have a background with closed time like curves,
it's not.
We don't know how to work with it, right?
That's right.
So the question is there anything from in theory which prevents you from going to the
ground? Right. But that's the point. That prevents you.
In what sense it prevents you?
Because the quantum corrections blow up, so you couldn't have. If you try and form the thing,
right? So
yeah. If you try as you try and form the thing, the quantum corrections blow up, and you couldn't trust the classical solution that may have tried
to
form it.
Exactly. Not that we prevent it.
Right.
You just went into that regime.
But again, the point is the existence of the closed time-like curve can't be used to rule out the theory unless you know what actually happens when you try to form it. I mean, I think we're agreeing, but my point is not against your perspective, but other people's perspective.
But this example would say that still it may be a good guide for ruling out the theory, because this theory cannot be completed. So, because it has a wrong sign for the limit for the amplitude, right?
Yeah,
so,
I'll come back. Yeah.
In the standard model, Z naught, as we say in character Z naught,
yeah,
has a mass, spin one, it's not abelian, and I think it's quite satisfactory.
That's right.
So, do you agree?
Yes, with that theory, yes.
So you're not worried about this.
That's right. That's a really normalizable theory, the characteristic analysis. Front velocity is 1, characteristic analysis gives the front, the velocity being 1. No ambiguities here. Everybody agrees on that. The discussion is about these types of theories. These Galileans, or the massive Proker, or the massive gravity, or all these theories in which you have higher derivative interactions you do not get in the non-abelian, in the Young-Mills example. Higher derivatives. So that you screw up the kinetic term. That's the key thing. That's what the discussion's about. Otherwise, it's all fine. So indeed, we know the perturbation theory breaks down there, and that's the effective metric. I guess I've already said that. So let me give you a little bit of a historical thing. I'm gonna run over, but lock the doors, lock everybody in.
Nobody's leaving.
It's a historical note, so even after the Villars-Wanziger paper and the Johnson-Sudarshan paper, so those authors, particularly Villars-Wanziger, were pretty clear to argue that for the first time, and now this argument's rather common, that in a Lorentz invariant theory, not all interactions are consistent with the Lorentz invariant UV completion, and they say that's not possible. And so the Villars-Wanziger example is exactly an exact answer of that. So let me give you an historical argument that was very shortly after that Eichelberg and Ecker and Sechsel, these two famous from the Eichelberg-Sechsel metric, criticized this result and said, in fact, you should be the other way around, that Lorentz invariants, in fact, would impose causality. And so this is the abstract of their paper. They say a class of Lorentz covariant Lagrangians is described which seem to violate like causality in the sense that the propagation of wavefronts and particles can be larger than the velocity of light. So that's exactly the type of things we're talking about. Simpler model of Lagrangian of this type, we consider a point particle coupled to massless rank spin 2 tensor field, so that kind of looks a bit like Galilean and massive gravity type theories. While it seems kinematically possible to accelerate a particle through the Minkowski light cone, it turns out that dynamical reasons prevent this. The reaction force due to the radiation emitted by the particle diverges when the particle approaches the Minkowski light cone. The simple model seems to indicate that Lorentz covariance is indeed sufficient to guarantee causality, and no restrictions concerning the type of couplings which may be claimed that Lagrangian are necessary. So our final conclusions, which we have proved for point particle models, as follows. The requirement of covariant couplings in Lagrangian theories is not sufficient to exclude superlight velocities. If, however, at least one interacting field exists in the theory which propagates normally, so the Minkowski light cone does not lose its meaning completely, no signals can propagate velocity v greater than 1. Now, what is the essence of their argument? It's basically, this is my version of stating it. The punchline of the argument is, let's suppose we take a theory in which we've got two fields, I'll call them Alice and Bob, just because we're in perimeter, in which one field, Alice, can naively be superluminal in some non-trivial background, but Bob, let's say, is always luminal, okay, based on a naive characteristic analysis or fluctuations around that background. So propagate an Alice particle, which we mean in the field theory context a wave packet, in a background for which Alice is superluminal and Bob is luminal. Then, of course, as everybody knows, if these two things are coupled in a particular way, then generically Alice will Cherenkov radiate into Bob. Now, the actual example they had is particularly is not a very good one, I think, from the modern point of view. But one could easily update the argument they had to something like a Galilean, where we can construct similar types of solutions. Okay, so find one Cherenkov's radiance into the other. Now let's just look at the standard Cherenkov radiation formula for charged particles in electromagnetic media. So the energy emitted per unit length of the particle as it runs along is proportional to the charge squared, because obviously it'd be zero if the things didn't interact. And it's given by some integral like this over frequencies. This is the permeability. Let's suppose it's 1 just for simplicity. And you see that the integrand grows with frequency. And the integral is performed over all frequencies for which the velocity of the charged particle is greater than the velocity in the fluid. So when this condition is true. And in particular, because the integral is over all such frequencies and the integrand grows with omega, the integral will always be dominated by the highest frequency for which this condition is satisfied. So the highest frequency at which you have one guy being superluminal relative to the other one. the other one, which of course is why Cherenkov radiation is blue. It's a high frequency radiation. But the point is, if Alice is superluminal, as we're imagining in this particular case, so V is greater than C, and let's suppose Bob is luminal in the sense that its front velocity is 1, and indeed, let's suppose that the phase velocity is less than 1 at all frequencies, which is what you'd expect for a normal reasonable system, then it is always true that the velocity is greater than C over n m omega. So in that case, there is no cutoff in this integral. Every single mode at every frequency, Cherenkov radiates.
So there is a cutoff at the Compton bending of the particle. You don't have a point particle. I mean, this is true for a point particle. But
yeah, I'm imagining a point particle.
You are. But that's where the cutoff is the Compton bending of the particle. In nature, I mean, this is a classical formula.
Right. That might be true. I have to think about that. But let's just imagine a point particle limit.
And I said that actually the cutoff comes from, you cannot emit infinite frequency photon because the maximum energy of the photons you can emit is the energy that you have. So that's
That's for sure.
It's the same cutoff as you were
saying.
That's for sure.
Similar,
yeah. No. Of course, you can't get infinite. Let me just run with their argument though. This is in essence what they were doing in the argument. So then what happened? They didn't do this calculation. This is my wishy-washy way of explaining the calculation they actually did. In the actual system that they looked at, they computed the amount of radiation, and the answer they get is indeed infinite, and the essence of the reason why that is true. And so then they argued that the point is to accelerate, to have even gotten into this situation in the first place, it would require an infinite amount of energy. So they said this would mean it requires an infinite amount of energy to accelerate a wave packet at velocities v greater than 1, which obviously would prevent the existence of signals faster than light. But what they're really saying, of course, it's not that there's actually infinite amount of energy. What they really mean is that the external field approximation that you used, i.e. perturbing around that particular background, you can no longer trust that calculation, because if you just did the calculation of perturbing around that background and you went to first order, then you would get an infinite answer. Well, that, of course, tells you have to include back reaction effects, so you have to take that into account.
I just told you about the loophole. It's not really infinite. It's finite. Because, the natural cutoff is the energy of the particle that's doing everything. So then, depending on what Q is, this could be just a very small effect.
Maybe. I think they would have argued that it was still a big effect. But we can think about that. We can think about that later. So I don't necessarily view this as an explanation of what's going on, but it's also another example of where you have to think a little bit more. You just do the fluctuation analysis, and it's true that you get one guy is superluminal relative to the other one, but when you take into account the interactions of those species, then things can get a little bit different. That's really...
You are not allowed, if the system has some Compton scale, you're not allowed to use even photon frequencies which are...
That's my point. Yeah, of course. I agree. Of course. That's right. But that goes into my point. Yeah. Yeah. So, but their argument would be that in this system, this was their argument, which I'm just reviewing, the front velocities of each of the species would have to be the same in order to make that answer finite. Okay. So
in a negative theory, there is a cutoff.
So, yeah. Okay,
so this calculation would be cutoff.
Right. So we would now modulate that by putting in a cutoff. But at that time, that's the argument they were making. Sorry. Right.
But even at that time, that wasn't the real cutoff. The real cutoff is the energy of the particle that's doing everything, not the cutoff of your theory.
Right. That's right. I mean, of course, there's always a cutoff that makes it finite.
You don't want particles above. I mean, the particles above the cutoff of the theory are not in the theory. So.
Right. But if it is the actual cutoff, it's still the point is that particular effect is something that's UV grows with the highest frequency, so you get something with a positive power.
Frequency the cutoff. Is not the cutoff. It's the mass of the particle.
No, let's forget the mass for a second. If it were the, to say is if it were the cutoff, then you would get a large effect because of the cutoff. Okay, I'll try to be quick. So I think actually I The real issue at some level, I think, really is, again, the analyticity issue in these theories. And I think at some level, the characteristic analysis, all that story, is a red herring. But the real issue is the analyticity one. And so let me remind you of that argument, and we've heard it said before, but if it's true that if you're in a Lorentz invariant theory and it's true that operators commute outside the light cone, then one can derive dispersion relations which start by using the Just-Lehmann-Dyson representation, where you prove that you look at the commutator between two momenta eigenstates, and you show that can be written as a superposition of the free commutator for a given effective mass square root of mu and some spectral density superposition which depends on space. But the point is, because the free commutator clearly vanishes outside the light cone, then this integral, as long as it converges, vanishes outside the light cone.
Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah. You're not going to argue with that, hope.
what type cone?
Oh, yeah. What I'm talking about is in an ordinary local field theory in which there is a clear light cone. I agree.
The light cone, the theory is completely well-behaved, but if you misidentify the light cone, right, then you see...
I agree. That's one of the issues, but I'm just reviewing the historical argument. So that may be one of the things to go. So again, the historical argument runs. So in a generic field theory, this thing grows polynomially, and you can do some subtractions that makes the integral converge. But from this formula, you can prove, and this is going to cause great success of the dispersion relation program, is that the forward scattering amplitude, so the 2-2 scattering amplitude, forward scattering amplitude, is analytic in the complex S plane, where S is the usual Mandelstam variable, modulo the usual branch cuts and poles on the real axis, with a finite number of subtractions. That was what Hepp proved. He couldn't say how many subtractions there were, but he could prove that it was analytic with a finite number. And then in local field theories, a key assumption was the polynomial boundedness assumption, which was assumed on the form of the scattering amplitude. And the logic of that was that it was argued that locality in a local field theory, if you just think about scalar field theory, then the Whiteman functions of that theory are tempered distributions, which means that the momenta space Whiteman functions do not grow faster than any polynomial in momenta. And it was argued that it was reasonable, and in fact proven based on this assumption, one can prove that the scattering amplitude doesn't grow faster than a polynomial, and that's the statement of polynomial boundedness, the scattering amplitude. And it's sort of intuitively obvious, but if you want to be rigorous about it, it's hard to get. And then with those assumptions, really Martin actually, so Foisa used something called the Mandelstam representation, which was a guess, but Martin really gave a rigorous proof of what we now call the Foisa-Martin bound, assuming polynomial boundedness and analyticity in what's called Martin's extension of the Lehmann ellipse, which requires a theory to have a mass gap. So let me draw that picture. So we're talking about the complex Mandelstam S plane. So S is basically E squared. And the statement is that if the theory has a mass gap, then the branch cut starts at 4m squared. And there may be poles in between, but the poles we can subtract out. So let's forget about the poles for a second. The issue here is the branch cut. And then there's a branch cut going backwards by crossing symmetry. And so if the theory has a mass gap, there's a little window here between these two branch cuts in which, so Hepp basically proved analyticity there's a little window here where you can extend analyticity because there's no branch cuts. So it's analytic here. And this is Martin's extension of the Lehmann ellipse. And with that assumption, Martin was able to show that if you only assume the dispersion relation has a finite number of subtractions, which means that it grows as a polynomial of finite order, then one could prove, based on analyticity, that number of subtractions was in fact never more than 2. In other words, that the amplitude itself never grows faster than linear power of S. And it has some logs in, but that's not really important. It's linear in S. And that is true only in theories with a mass gap, and indeed that coefficient has a 1 over m squared there. So if m was 0, what happens is that the branch cut comes all the way back. And in fact, you can't prove that this is no longer the formula. What happens in the massless limit is the amplitude has to be only smaller than some polynomial, but it can be of any order. That's the best you can prove. In the massless limit, in the massive limit, there's this remarkably strong constraint that it can't grow faster than S log S squared. Yes.
So in the massless case, sometimes it's actually infinite.
That's right. It can be infinite. Yes. That's right. That's right. I think if you subtract, but I think one can make a statement even if you subtract out the pole contribution, you can make the same statement. So then that says the cross section can't grow faster than this. And then the argument goes, if you look at the, if you assume the amplitude is analytic, I can write down a dispersion relation for the amplitude. We're written in terms of the one takes this contour around the thing, and across each branch cut, you just get the imaginary part because these two, this thing is basically the complex conjugate of that, and so the two coming in opposite directions. And so you can write the amplitude at any point in the complex plane in terms of an integral around coming from the branch cuts modulo the number of the subtractions you have to do. And if you assume the Foisel-Martin bound, the number of subtractions is 2. And what that means is the amplitude is some unknown coefficient plus s times an unknown coefficient plus two integrals up to some pole terms as well.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Okay.
Thank
you, Andrew.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can just pick up right from here.
Actually, I've got like 3 slides. You just. I'm sorry. So reviewing the argument. And then in this paper, which several of the authors are in this room, the point was made. Now, if I take that formula, if I differentiate twice, and I take m goes to 0, then the double derivative of the amplitude is equal to the integral of the imaginary part. And again, like in the Kramers-Kronig, but here more solid, the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude has to be positive by unitarity, because the imaginary part is determined by the cross section. And therefore, in the limit m goes to 0, this statement has to be positive. And the problem is that for all Galilean models, and by extension, all massive gravity theories, and by extension, all bigravity and multigravity theories, this thing starts at lowest order at s cubed and t cubed and u cubed just by the Galilean symmetry. And so a double prime equals 0 in the massless limit, which violates this particular condition because the right-hand side has to be positive, the left-hand side is not positive. And so this is the statement that Galileans do not admit Lorentz invariant UV completion. And the assumptions that go into that, in fact, is analyticity of the JLD representation, but that can be proved from locality of the field theory, so that's not really an assumption. Polynomial boundedness is an assumption, but you can prove it from the Whiteman axioms, again, from locality. There is assumption of a mass gap, and then these things together imply the Foisel-Martin bound, and that implies that without so on. And these arguments were originally used to rule out the DGP model, but in the case of the DGP model, there's not actually a mass gap because the Galilean, which arises the Liszt zero mode of the massive graviton, is really a resonance state, and it includes contributions from masses at arbitrarily low. So in fact, the branch cut comes all the way to the origin. And if the branch cut comes to the origin, you can't use Martin's extension of the Lehmann ellipse, which you need to prove the Foisel-Martin bound. So it could be that in the DGP model, although no one's calculated what the actual cross-section would scale like, it could be that in the DGP model, there's actually no contradiction. And that would run as follows. If you give up the Foisel-Martin bound, which you have if the theory doesn't have a mass gap like in the DGP model, then you can still, from HEP, you can still approve polynomial boundedness, but you don't have to have only 2 subtractions. You can have as many as 3 subtractions. And already, if you add 1 extra subtraction in this formula, then instead of getting a condition on A double prime, you get a condition on A four primes. And if you write A four primes down, it has to scale like S to the 4 at small s. But in fact, there is a Galilean operator that you can write down that gives you precisely that answer. So provided you give up the Foisel-Martin bound, which you would have if you don't have a mass gap, then the Galilean symmetry per se is not in conflict with unitarity and analyticity. And I'll conclude there. That's it. Sorry.